Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
So let's go to those said stories. Delighted to be joined by Louisa Meehan of Woodview HRM and Stephen O'Leary, the founder and CEO of Alitico. You're both very welcome to the programme.
Morning, Bobby.
Morning, Bobby.
Morning to you both. I thought some of the debate and analysis around the presidential race was worthy of discussion this morning. So my first piece that caught my eye very early this morning was Pat Leahy's piece, who says that landmines abound on the path to the presidency. And he gives some pretty good examples, does he not, of you're done, you're damned if you contribute, and then you're damned if you opt out.
Yeah, this is this is Pat Leahy writing in the Irish Times, and it's well worth a read because he essentially goes party by party.
Right? Yeah.
So he takes us through each of the individual political parties and gives the reasons why it might be a good idea for them to field a candidate and support someone clearly. And then he also talks about the perils of it. But more broadly, he talks about the fact that really it's very hard to predict whether the candidate you put forward has any material positive or negative impact on you as a party.
Yeah.
And this sense of unknown continues to be there. So while everyone wants to have someone in the race and everyone wants a winner, the actual impact of backing the winner, and he makes the point here of like, over the last 14 years, can Labour really point to a marked benefit, for example, from having put forward the presidential candidate that ultimately went on to win?
Yeah, and even if you look at Alan Kelly's comments earlier in the week on Catherine Connolly, you know, you'd kind of say, is that somebody from Labour speaking about that?
Yeah, and it's been a really interesting week, and I suppose it's come to a crux really in the last 24 hours because we're now beginning to see more clearly the potential candidates that are going to be in this race, and I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing so much opinion and analysis on this in the papers.
Louisa, in terms of who's doing what, and Stephen outlined the sort of perils that are highlighted by Pat Leahy's articles, Sinn Féin have yet to declare, and again, they could be probably accused of faffing around on this because, you know, as things start to crystallise and their position is still unclear, this could come back to bite them.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I mean, they certainly need to put forward a candidate if they want to consider themselves to be one of the largest political parties in the country and to have a voice. You know, it's currently looking like Heather Humphreys will be the nomination for Fine Gael. Jim Gavin got nominated yesterday evening and they seem to be the two front runners as it stands today. But who's going to be coming up against them and what that looks like will be interesting. And certainly Pat Leahy talks to Simon Harris and Fine Gael and saying that whilst it's important to put somebody forward, they don't necessarily have to win. But if it's a disaster, then what's the backlash?
Gay Mitchell have been a case in point, whereby he really, really disappointed, and the collateral damage to the party. And this is what they're all terrified of, that if you perform badly, is it better to perform badly than not perform at all?
Yeah,
and like each case is different.
I mean, certainly the sentiment is that you're better to not perform at all than to perform badly. So I think we're going to have to wait and see. One thing that I do think is positive, I suppose, from an Irish perspective, is that the current president, whoever they are, doesn't seem to have a major impact on the political party that they came from. And if you look at the US and the presidential campaigns over there, that is a good thing, hopefully.
Matt Cooper's analysis is good as well, Stephen, in that he talks about, you know, watch the guys at the back of the race rather than the people at the front, because there's still a lot to run on this.
Yeah, he calls out kind of like the two main talking points, I guess, of this week, which is one, that it's been a bad week, objectively, for Catherine Connolly for a range of reasons. You mentioned the comments by Alan Kelly. But then also it's been an interesting week for Fianna Fáil with, you know, the emergence of a couple of candidates. And I suppose in Jim Gavin, one that's really got a lot of people talking. And certainly Cooper sets out the reasons why he could potentially be a good candidate for Fianna Fáil and talks about his like broad appeal. Right. So that obviously the Dublin centric nature of that is pretty obvious given his sporting past. But then the broader GA community, although Cooper does quip that it may not go down very well with the exception of people in Mayo, right? So there will be some counties, I'm sure, who may not relish him as their president. But certainly his emergence and that of Billy Kelleher as potential candidates have led to increased conversation about this. And I'd expect we'll see this story begin to heat up as the next few days progress.
Yeah. Now, the next story is one of great interest and may even interest me personally. But Claire Byrne leaving RTÉ for News Talk before expected pay cut. And I'll let you guys debate this rather than say too much about it, as I actually work here at this station. But a lot of talk yesterday, some big announcements, Pat Kenny moving to the weekends, Claire Byrne joining us here at the station. There's a bit to run on this yet, Louisa.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think we're a small country. There aren't that many stations out there talking about the news. So it is good to see some change and some moving deck chairs. And as you said, Pat Kenny has been here for quite a long time, having come from RTÉ originally. He's moving to the weekend, so he's giving up that Monday to Friday slot. I was talking with Stephen earlier going, I wonder what his wife thinks about that, because he's working for a long, long time. So he's going to be at home.
He's going to love the weekend.
He's going to love it.
I can testify for that. He's going to love it.
And then, you know, Claire Byrne has already taken a step back from the combination of radio and television to radio only. That had a cut in her salary, which was significant. The salary cut that she would have to take then in relation to the rule that was put in by Kevin Backhurst, which would bring her down to a maximum of 250,000, may have been an impetus for her to change.
Follow the money, as they say.
Follow the money. So I don't know what people are getting paid here in News Talk. That's a whole other story for a whole other day. But it's good. I mean, I think News Talk are coming out the clear winners in this, and it's a success story.
And as articulated by Mick Heaney in today's Irish Times, Stephen, he clearly says that this causes RTÉ more problems, and that News Talk is the clear winner here, which I have to say I agree with.
He does. He's also got probably the line of the weekend in the papers. To paraphrase Oscar Wilde, to lose one Today Show presenter to News Talk may be regarded as misfortune. To lose two looks like carelessness, which really is.
Well, that's over 15 years, mind.
Yeah, and, yeah. You know, he goes into a lot of detail about kind of, you know, things like the JLR figures and the impact of those and the replacement of, you know, obviously David McCullough, the anchor of the 6-1 News on RTÉ Television, coming in to replace Byrne as the Today host. The interesting thing that I took from this too was he alludes to McCullough's performance on the podcast. And I do think that is an interesting feature in this too, that in the past we probably traditionally would have thought about, it's all about the JLRs, it's all about your performance on live broadcast. But increasingly we see the importance, especially in broadcast media in Ireland, of podcasts.
Sure.
And so I'm sure that's a factor that's been looked at, and the performance of that podcast is a factor that's been looked at when RTÉ would have lined up a replacement.
Sure, sure. Okay, well, we'll see what happens. More to run on this, no doubt. Markets shudder amid tariff fears and concerns over a bank levy in the UK, Louisa.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is, I suppose it's looking at the stock markets over the last couple of days and saying that there's been an impact across many of the stock markets because of an incoming bank levy in the UK and because of the US tariff situation, which is still a little bit of an unknown. I suppose I would treat it with a little piece of caution in that it's looking at a small period of time. And when we're looking at the markets, you really need to be looking at a more protracted period and stability. So they're talking about the inflation figures being encouraging, giving investors hope because they are more stable than they have been. You know, for me, the biggest issue in this is the instability that's been caused by the tariffs in the US and the impact that that's having on the global stock markets, yeah, including the Irish one.
And interesting, I was hearing this morning that the US appeals court has ruled that most tariffs imposed by Donald Trump are illegal. The judges said that while the president has considerable powers to respond to national emergencies, they don't extend to imposing import taxes, which could be a very interesting development in this, Stephen.
It could, but it kind of it brings us back to the problems of executive orders and a president who at a whim can decide to make, you know, kind of fairly significant, yeah, decisions on how the US economy runs. I think, you know, there are kind of two parts to this story. One is obviously these the impact on inflation and rising prices in the US. But the other, and this has also been talked about, particularly from an Irish point of view this week, is the tariff exemption that has run out or expired this week, which is for imports valued under $800. And certainly there will be smaller Irish businesses that export to the US. And we've seen this discussed during the week.
And I think there's some confusion around that, which is, again, never great, because that means the consumer may not engage.
Absolutely.
If they're not sure.
Yeah, and we want small businesses in particular to be able to plan and to budget and to be able to, you know, make good, pertinent decisions about how they expect their businesses to grow. This undermines that.
Yeah. Let's move to Cliff Taylor's piece in today's Irish Times, Louisa.
Yeah.
Ireland's quiet prosperity boom. Number of those earning more than €100,000 doubles. Just some very interesting stats in this.
There are certainly, and I mean, if you look at some of the headlines, it would make us sound like we're all incredibly prosperous.
Maybe
and,
bring us through a couple of
and
those.
And it's flying ahead. So they're saying that there's almost 420,000 taxpayers. Now, taxpayers could be a unit, as in a married couple, not an individual, who are set to exceed incomes of 100,000 next year. That's about 12% of the total population, more than double the 206,000 earners in this category in 2020. So a significant increase in a relatively short period of time. It represents about 7.5% of the total number of taxpayers. What I think is particularly interesting is the volume of tax that those individuals are paying. And they are paying a very high percentage. So it's estimated that as recently as 2022, 38% of all income tax came from those earning more than 100,000. Next year, it's estimated to be at 47%. So, you know, whilst they are really big numbers, on one hand, they're not necessarily big numbers if you're trying to pay for a mortgage and creche and run a house and you're paying 50% of that money away in tax and it's two people bringing the money into a household.
Yeah, and he also alludes to the fact that, you know, a household earning €300,000 annual income, you know, may not have much left at the end of the month on the basis of their commitments around mortgages, etc.
Yes, but he qualifies that by saying this may not elicit a lot of sympathy from the vast majority on more modest earnings. And I would imagine the vast majority listening to the program this morning, you know, may kind of feel similarly. But there is nervousness, right, within that higher earning group, because he also makes the point that a lot of them are potentially in technology or professional services. You know, we've seen even this week the comments from Trump about, you know, how he may retaliate or attack the regulation of digital technology companies in the EU. And there's kind of concerns there about what happens, the kind of the weaponization potentially of this story when it comes to the trade talks with the EU. So I would imagine within that cohort, there is an element of nervousness about maybe some of those roles and what they'll look like into the future.
Yeah. And I think you're right. You know, we look at figures of this appears to convey that we're a very wealthy society. There are lots of people struggling outside of these numbers. And I think you're right. This whole, there's a kind of a vulnerability that's potentially there now around employment numbers. And even in our next story, we see some CSO data confirming a silent slowdown as jobs growth stalls, Louisa. I just thought this was interesting as well. You know, when you balance this with Cliff Taylor's numbers and he talks about foreign direct investment and tech companies and people earning $100,000 plus a year, here we see at the other side of that coin, which is, you know, 88,935 job destructions, as they're being called, which is nearly a 10% decrease in the number of recorded jobs over a 12-month period.
Yes, I mean, what they're really talking about in a nutshell is that there is an increase in the number of people exiting out of jobs, maybe through redundancies. And they give one example of Dundrum House, golf and restaurant venue in County Tipperary, which is closing with a loss of 48 jobs. That's a small number on its own, but that is happening quite a lot. And it's something that I deal with dealing with redundancies and collective redundancies. And when you talk to the department, they're seeing a spike and increase in those areas. That's coming through here. They're also talking about a lot more stability in relation to people not moving jobs
sign that people are nervous.
It's a sign that people
stay where
you
are because you won't risk
exactly
the potential of a new scenario.
Yeah, and I think, you know, even linking this back with the previous article, there is a very big difference between wealth and income. So you can have a high income, but not necessarily be wealthy. Wealth is about freedom of choice. And what this article here from the CSO is demonstrating is a lack of choice for individuals, that they are feeling an instability in the job market, and that they are sort of nervous to make choices around their life that might suit them better, with the majority of workers, the vast bulk, 2.56 million people staying in their existing employment, which is the highest in the series, and a potential sign of nervousness. So that's a really high number of people. Great that they have a job and that they can stay, but choice is what a wealthy person has choice.
Yeah, I think it's good to look at these numbers in terms of balance, Stephen.
Yeah, I think especially in light of the last story, I also think, you know, this is Donal O'Donovan writing in the Irish Independent. And what I like about this is you've got the source of data from the CSO, but he's also spoken to people in the sector. So, you know, Neil Hughes from Assets Ireland has got like 4,000 small and medium enterprises that he can kind of look to. And that gives that level of insight into the distress in the Irish economy as it's described here. And now he uses the term the risk of triggering a job crisis, which obviously is maybe kind of slightly alarmist. But there are these individual examples that get talked about. And as Louisa said earlier, the two sectors that seem to be at particular risk are retail and hospitality.
Yeah.
And they're the ones I think that there'll be the closest focus on over the next kind of 3 months.
Yeah. Just a business story. The NCT test provider, Applus's profits increased sixfold to 6 million in 2024. Not a bad business, checking in the old NCT on cars. They're making a good return to, I think it's their Spanish parent. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's actually really good. And for me, I work with people in hospitality and retail, and I also work with people in the car industry. And if I was to say to somebody, which of those three would you get into, it would be go and become a mechanic, because it's extremely difficult to get mechanics. And what we're seeing here is, you know, steady growth in terms of profitability, dividends going back. And we're also seeing that they have 600 plus inspectors who are all fully qualified mechanics across 50 different locations throughout Ireland. Now, whilst their profits are increasing and their revenue is increasing, their costs also increased significantly. So they rose to 97 million last year from 90 million the previous year, which is something to keep note of.
One of the things that slightly perplexed me was, how do you go from 1 million profit in 2023 to 6.6 million in 2024, and the business doesn't seem to have changed that much?
Well, revenue is up, right? So there is an increase in revenue in the time period, and like it, on the outside, without being privy to maybe exactly how sort of the business works and its inner workings, it would appear they're getting more output from maybe less input, right? That would appear to be kind of what we're seeing here. But what's really interesting, again, from like a positive point of view here, is that they paid out almost 50 million euros in wages, welfare and pensions in 2024. Yeah. So this is not a case of a company that aren't giving back. This is someone who is significantly contributing to the Irish
economy. Another interesting thing about it is that it's basically a 10-year contract to operate the NCT service from 2019. The deal runs from 2020 to 2030. So the value of that business as that contract, which it appears is their sole income, you know, as that matures, you know, that needs to be reflected in the value of the business. In other words, a renewal could fundamentally change what you're dealing with here.
And you would imagine when this gets retendered in 2030, these types of stories are the things that will be pointed to when they're trying to evaluate, you know, how much this should be worth.
Stephen, when we have you there, talk to us about the Dublin Chamber. And I know you're chair of said organisation, backing Metrolink, while some big hitters, Michael O'Leary, Dermot Desmond, coming out saying that it's the wrong place to spend money, that we're better off putting it into self-drive vehicles and other things. I struggle with Michael O'Leary's argument against this, because I think every capital city should have a link from the airport to the city centre, and a proper one.
Yeah, and I suppose even more than that, because I agree entirely, and the Dublin Chamber has been consistent in their voice on this over many years. It's not just about the airport. This is a service that extends far beyond the airport and has the potential to have a really significant positive impact on the broader and greater Dublin economy and beyond. So, very simply, Dublin Chamber is reflecting what Dublin business wants here. It is the voice of Dublin business. And this is a case where you can choose to listen to a few loud, prominent voices of individuals who are quoted in the article and have made their personal opinions of this very, very clear. Or you can listen to the 40% of people who, in response to the Chamber survey, said this was the number one priority. Yeah. When it came to public transport infrastructure. I mean, there is no doubting the positive impact this has.
And, you know, I just want to endorse that by saying that there are people, those 40% that you say, there are people who are likely going to be disrupted to, in the process of delivering this. So,
were also the people who would have been disrupted by, imagine the Lewis didn't exist.
Yeah.
Imagine you lived in Dublin and at the point the Lewis was being constructed.
I remember I was trying to trade on six of the streets that the Lewis was being developed on. And it was very, very difficult.
Absolutely. And it is not in question that supports will be needed to give into businesses who are impacted by the infrastructure development here at the time it's being built. And we have seen the history of those supports being given, but it is imperative this happens.
Louisa, what about workers really wanting to go back to the office? Again, there's been a lot of chat about this. But some cancelling in today's Irish Times is sort of maybe questioning in a kind of a tongue-in-cheek way the validity of an estate agent effectively giving a survey saying that everybody wants to be back in the office.
Yeah, certainly.
You when they're selling office space.
Well, firstly, it made me feel really old when he said that the COVID pandemic was half a decade ago. I was like, we don't need to call it a decade yet or include that. You know, from a HR perspective, I deal with companies and businesses all the time. And most people who have got used to working from home do not want to go back into the office on a permanent basis.
The genie's out of the bottle.
And it makes for a better life. Like, I was an advocate for remote working for the last 20 years. This is not something that's new to me. It's something that I've been an advocate for forever. It is so much better for an individual, for the company, for the environment, for the family, for the community. Where we want to get to, though, is the hybrid working, where people are in the office some of the time. So you have the connection with your colleagues, you're building those relationships, etc. I'm just back from the States, and I was in a few different cities over there, LA, San Francisco and Seattle. And in each of them, what I noticed is the same as what we have here is office spaces for lease everywhere.
Yeah.
Like so much vacant property. And so if we have all of this space, we have a housing crisis, we have people who don't want to go back in the office, we maybe need to take a step back and say, well, how do we re-energize these areas to protect the cafes? He talks about the cafes, the shops, the smaller traders who are impacted by office workers not being there. Well, okay, what do we do to create a more sustainable future?
I think as well that in time, you know, what will ultimately happen is that will actually happen. It'll take years.
It will take
years.
But
ultimately, it's because it's the only logical explanation. You got a building that's empty. It's in a good state of repair. And there's a demand. And maybe we just have to, but it'll take a while and it'll take time. But I think ultimately, that's the only solution.
But, you know, it doesn't have to take a huge amount of time if we have the right attitude and approach towards it, because it just takes an investment.
Stephen, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, I think the key thing for me in this, and obviously this is all about, like you say, the story you want to tell, and this is coming from a property agent, so that's the major qualifier here. But it's, you know, there are things in here that can be interpreted in two different ways, right? So it talks about the fact that 63% of workers feel good about the return to office policies. Now, I think that's a fair comment. If the office policy was, or the return to office policy was, one day a week or 2 days a week, I reckon if you ask people who were mandated to come back in 5 days a week, that percentage may change. So I think there is nuance in here that you might want to dig behind to properly understand what the true sentiment is of workers who want to return to the office.
And I'll be chatting a bit later in the programme to three HR professionals, and I know, Louisa, that's your space.
It is.
But it'll be interesting to hear, you know, their take on where we're at now, as you articulated your own view of, because it is a very changing marketplace, and we need to change with it. Now, I don't know about your investment strategy, Stephen, but I'm going to recommend a bottle of Romani Conti. Pour a little into wine and stay out of the red. The money doctor, John Lowe, telling us maybe that wine is a good investment in his column in the Mail today.
Well, Bobby, with the spare 40 grand you have lying around and wondering what to do with it, you'll be happy to know that you can buy a bottle of said wine, a 1990 vintage of it, in the K Club at the moment, the most expensive bottle that they currently stock. But Lowe makes the point that if you had a bottle that was 10 years older, the 1980 vintage, you would have the most expensive bottle of wine ever bought at auction, which sold for almost €500,000. So his point is that it can pay to invest in your wine.
And if you don't like it as an investment, you can always drink it. What do you think, Louisa?
Do you know what I think? Do you remember the piece of art which was the banana on the wall? And this to me feels Andy
Warhol.
Like that. Yes. It's like, you know, if you have the money there, fire ahead. But this should be for fun. This is not a sound investment. A bottle of wine can be broken very easily. I'm not sure how you go about insuring it and storing it. And what if the wrong person rocks into your wine cellar and opens it up when you're not even there to taste it? So I would treat it with caution.
All right. Well, I want to thank both my guests, Louisa Meehan from Woodview HRM and Stephen O'Leary from Alitica. Always a pleasure to talk to you both. And thanks for coming in this morning.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.